The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 26. You're right. My name is Harry Lucas. My father was a retired soldier who came out to farm in Rhodesia. He died when I was in my second year at Cambridge. Were you fond of him? I asked suddenly. I don't know. Then he flushed and went on with sudden vehemence. Why do I say that? I did love my father. We said bitter things to each other the last time I saw him, and we had many rows over my wildness and my debts. But I cared for the old man. I know how much now, when it's too late, he continued more quietly. It was at Cambridge that I met the other fellow. Young Eardsley? Yes, young Eardsley. His father, as you know, was one of South Africa's most prominent men. We drifted together at once, my friend and I. We had our love of South Africa in common, and we both had a taste for the untrodden places of the world. After he left Cambridge, Eardsley had a final quarrel with his father. The old man had paid his debts twice. He refused to do so again. There was a bitter scene between them. Sir Lawrence declared himself at the end of his patience. He would do no more for his son. He must stand on his own legs for a while. The result was, as you know, that those two young men went off to South Africa together, prospecting for diamonds. I'm not going into that now, but we had a wonderful time out there. Hardships in plenty, you understand, but it was a good life. A hand-to-mouth scramble for existence far from the beaten track. And my God, that's the place to know a friend. There was a bond forged between us two out there that only death could have broken. Well, as Colonel Race told you, our efforts were crowned with success. We found a second Kimberley in the heart of the British Guiana jungles. I can't tell you our elation. It wasn't so much the actual value in the money of the find. You see, Eardsley was used to money, and he knew that when his father died he'd be a millionaire. And Lucas had always been poor and was used to it. No, it was the sheer delight of discovery. He paused, and then added, almost apologetically, "You don't mind my telling it this way, do you? As though I wasn't in it at all. It seems like that now when I look back and see those two boys. I almost forget that one of them was Harry Raeburn." "Tell it any way you like," I said, and he went on. "We came to Kimberley. Very cock-a-hoop over our find. We brought a magnificent selection of diamonds with us to submit to the experts. And then, in the hotel at Kimberley, we met her." I stiffened a little, and the hand that rested on the doorpost clenched itself involuntarily. Anita Grunberg, that was her name. She was an actress, quite young and very beautiful. She was South African-born, but her mother was a Hungarian, I believe. There was some sort of mystery about her, and that, of course, heightened her attraction for two boys home from the wilds. She must have had an easy task. We both fell for her right away, and we both took it hard. It was the first shadow that had ever come between us, but even then it didn't weaken our friendship. Each of us, I honestly believe, was willing to stand aside for the other to go in and win. But that wasn't her game. Sometimes afterwards, I wondered why it hadn't been. For Sir Lawrence Eardsley's only son was quite a parti. But the truth of it was that she was married to a sorter in De Beers, though nobody knew it. She pretended enormous interests in our discovery, and we told her all about it and even showed her the diamonds. Delilah, that's what she would have been called, and she played her part well. The De Beers robbery was discovered, and like a thunderclap, the police came down upon us. They seized our diamonds. We only laughed at first. The whole thing was so absurd. And then the diamonds were produced in court, and without question, they were the stones stolen from De Beers. Anita Grunberg had disappeared. She had effected the substitution neatly enough, and our story, that these were not the stones originally in our possession, was laughed to scorn. Sir Lawrence Eardsley had enormous influence. He succeeded in getting the case dismissed, but it left two young men ruined and disgraced to face the world with the stigma of thief attached to their names, and it pretty well broke the old fellow's heart. He had one bitter interview with his son in which he heaped upon him every reproach imaginable. He had done what he could to save the family name, but from that day on his son was his son no longer. He cast him off utterly, and the boy, like the proud young fool that he was, remained silent, disdaining to protest his innocence in the face of his father's disbelief. He came out furious from the interview. His friend was waiting for him. A week later, war was declared. The two friends enlisted together. You know what happened. The best pal a man ever had was killed, partly through his own mad recklessness in rushing into unnecessary danger. He died with his name tarnished. I swear to you, Anne, that it was mainly on his account that I was so bitter against that woman. It had gone deeper with him than with me. I had been madly in love with her for the moment. I even think that I frightened her sometimes. But with him, it was a quieter and deeper feeling. She had been the very center of his universe, and her betrayal of him tore up the very roots of life. The blow stunned him and left him paralyzed. Harry paused, and after a minute or two, he went on. As you know, I was reported missing, presumed killed. I never troubled to correct the mistake. I took the name of Parker and came to this island, which I knew of old. At the beginning of the war, I had had ambitious hopes of proving my innocence, but now all that spirit seemed dead. All I felt was, what's the good? My pal was dead. Neither he nor I had any living relations who would care. I was supposed to be dead too. Let it remain at that. I led a peaceful existence here, neither happy nor unhappy, numbed of all feeling. I see now, though, I didn't realize it at the time, that that was partly the effect of the war. And then one day, something occurred to wake me right up again. I was taking a party of people in my boat on a trip up the river, and I was standing at the landing stage, helping them in, when one of the men uttered a startled exclamation. It focused my attention on him. He was a small, thin man with a beard, and he was staring at me for all he was worth, as though I was a ghost. So powerful was his emotion that it awakened my curiosity. I made inquiries about him at the hotel and learned that his name was Carton, that he came from Kimberley, and that he was a diamond sorter employed by De Beers. In a minute, all the old sense of wrong surged over me again. I left the island and went to Kimberley. I could find out little more about him, however. In the end, I decided that I must force an interview. I took my revolver with me. In the brief glimpse I had had of him, I had realized that he was a physical coward. No sooner were we face to face than I recognized that he was afraid of me. I soon forced him to tell me all he knew. He had engineered part of the robbery, and Anita Grunberg was his wife. He had once caught sight of both of us when we were dining with her at the hotel, and having read that I was killed, my appearance in the flesh at the falls startled him badly. He and Anita had married quite young, but she had soon drifted away from him. She had got in with a bad lot, he told me, and it was then, for the first time, that I heard of the Colonel. Carton himself had never been mixed up in anything except this one affair, so he solemnly assured me, and I was inclined to believe him. He was emphatically not of the stuff of which successful criminals are made. I still had the feeling that he was keeping back something. As a test, I threatened to shoot him there and then, declaring that I cared very little what became of me now. In a frenzy of terror, he poured out a further story. It seems that Anita Grunberg did not quite trust the colonel. While pretending to hand over to him the stones she had taken from the hotel, she kept back some in her own possession. Carton advised her, with his technical knowledge, which to keep. If, at any time, these stones were produced, They were of such color and quality as to be readily identifiable, and the experts at De Beers would admit at once that these stones had never passed through their hands. In this way, my story of a substitution would be supported, my name would be cleared, and suspicion would be diverted to the proper quarter. I gathered that, contrary to his usual practice, the colonel himself had been concerned in this affair. Therefore, Anita felt satisfied that she had a real hold over him, should she need it. Carton now proposed that I should make a bargain with Anita Grunberg, or Nadina, as she now called herself. For a sufficient sum of money, he thought that she would be willing to give up the diamonds and betray her former employer. He would cable to her immediately. I was still suspicious of Carton. He was a man whom it was easy enough to frighten, but who, in his fright, would tell so many lies that to sift the truth out from them would be no easy job. I went back to the hotel and waited. By the following evening, I judged that he would have received the reply to his cable. I called round at his house and was told that Mr. Carton was away, but would be returning on the morrow. Instantly, I became suspicious. In the nick of time, I found out that he was in reality sailing for England on the Kilmorden Castle, which left Cape Town in 2 days' time. I had just time to journey down and catch the same boat. I had no intention of alarming Carton by revealing my presence on board. I had done a good deal of acting in my time at Cambridge, and it was comparatively easy for me to transform myself into a grave, bearded gentleman of middle age. I avoided Carton carefully on board the boat, keeping to my own cabin as far as possible under the pretense of illness. I had no difficulty in trailing him when we got to London. He went straight to a hotel and did not go out until the following day. He left the hotel shortly before 1 o'clock. I was behind him. He went straight to a house agent in Knightsbridge. There he asked for particulars of houses to be let on the river. I was at the next table, also inquiring about houses. Then suddenly, in walked Anita Grunberg. Nadina, whatever you like to call her. Superb, insolent, and almost as beautiful as ever. God, how I hated her. There she was, the woman who had ruined my life, and who had also ruined a better life than mine. At that minute, I could have put my hands round her neck and squeezed the life out of her inch by inch. Just for a minute or two, I saw red. I hardly took in what the agent was saying. It was her voice that I heard next, high and clear, with an exaggerated foreign accent. "The Mill House, Marlowe, the property of Sir Eustace Pedler. That sounds as though it might suit me. At any rate, I'll go see it." The man wrote her an order, and she walked out again in her regal, insolent manner. Not by word or a sign had she recognized Carton, yet I was sure that their meeting there was a preconceived plan. Then I started to jump to conclusions. Not knowing that Sir Eustace was at Cannes, I thought that this house-hunting business was a mere pretext for meeting him in the Mill House. I knew that he had been in South Africa at the time of the robbery, and never having seen him, I immediately leaped to the conclusion that he himself was the mysterious colonel of whom I'd heard so much. I followed my two suspects along Knightsbridge. Nadina went into the Hyde Park Hotel. I quickened my pace and went in also. She walked straight into the restaurant, and I decided that I would not risk her recognizing me at that moment, but would continue to follow Carton. I was in great hopes that he was going to get the diamonds, and that by suddenly appearing and making myself known to him when he least expected it, I might startle the truth out of him. I followed him down into the tube station at Hyde Park Corner. He was standing by himself at the end of the platform. There was some girl standing near, but no one else. I decided that I would accost him then and there. You know what happened. In the sudden shock of seeing a man whom he imagined far away in South Africa, he lost his head and stepped back upon the line. He was always a coward. Under the pretext of being a doctor, I managed to search his pockets. There was a wallet with some notes in it and one or two unimportant letters. There was a roll of films, which I must have dropped somewhere later. And there was a piece of paper with an appointment made on it for the 22nd on the Kilmorden Castle. In my haste to get away before anyone detained me, I dropped that also. But fortunately, I remembered the figures. I hurried to the nearest cloakroom and hastily removed my makeup. I didn't want to be laid by the heels for picking a dead man's pocket. Then I retraced my steps to the Hyde Park Hotel. Nadina was still having lunch. I needn't describe in detail how I followed her down to Marlowe. She went into the house, and I spoke to the woman at the lodge, pretending that I was with her. Then I too went in. He stopped. There was a tense silence. "You will believe me, Anne, won't you? I swear before God that what I'm going to say is true. I went into the house after her with something very like murder in my heart, and she was dead. I found her in that first floor room. God, it was horrible. Dead, and I was not more than 3 minutes behind her. There was no sign of anyone else in the house. Of course, I realized at once the terrible position I was in. By one master stroke, the blackmailed had rid himself of the blackmailer, and at the same time had provided a victim to whom the crime would be ascribed. The hand of the colonel was very plain. For the second time, I was to be his victim. Fool that I had been to walk into the trap so easily. I hardly know what I did next. I managed to go out of the place looking fairly normal, but I knew that it could not be long before the crime was discovered and a description of my appearance telegraphed all over the country. I lay low for some days, not daring to make a move. In the end, chance came to my aid. I overheard a conversation between two middle-aged gentlemen in the street, one of whom proved to be Sir Eustace Pedler. I at once conceived the idea of attaching myself to him as his secretary. The fragment of conversation I had overheard gave me my clue. I was now no longer so sure that Sir Eustace Pedler was the colonel. His house might have been appointed as a rendezvous by accident, or for some obscure motive that I had not fathomed. "Do you know," I interrupted, "that Guy Paget was in Marlowe at the date of the murder?" "That settles it, then. I thought he was at Cannes with Sir Eustace." "He was supposed to be in Florence, but he certainly never went there. I'm pretty certain he was really in Marlowe, but of course I can't prove it." "And to think I never suspected Paget for a minute until the night he tried to throw you overboard. The man's a marvelous actor." "Yes, isn't he?" "That explains why the Mill House was chosen. Paget could probably get in and out of it unobserved. Of course, he made no objection to my accompanying Sir Eustace across in the boat. He didn't want me laid by the heels immediately." "You see, evidently, Nadina didn't bring the jewels with her to the rendezvous as they had counted on her doing. I fancy that Carton really had them and concealed them somewhere on the Kilmorden Castle. That's where he came in. They hoped that I might have some clue as to where they were hidden. As long as the colonel didn't recover the diamonds, he was still in danger. Hence, his anxiety to get them at all costs. Where the devil Carton hid them, if he did hide them, I don't know." "That's another story," I quoted. "My story. And I'm going to tell it to you now." Chapter 27. Harry listened attentively while I recounted all the events that I have narrated in these pages. The thing that bewildered and astonished him most was to find that all along the diamonds had been in my possession, or rather in Suzanne's. That was a fact he'd never suspected. Of course, after hearing his story, I realized the point of Carton's little arrangement, or rather Nadina's, since I had no doubt that it was her brain which had conceived the plan. No surprise tactics executed against her or her husband could result in the seizure of the diamonds. The secret was locked in her own brain. and the colonel was not likely to guess that they had been entrusted to the keeping of an ocean steward. Harry's vindication from the old charge of theft seemed assured. It was the other, graver charge that paralyzed all our activities, for as things stood, he could not come out in the open to prove his case. The one thing we came back to again and again was the identity of the colonel. Was he, or was he not, Guy Paget? "I should say he was, but for one thing," said Harry. "It seems pretty much of a certainty that it was Paget who murdered Anita Grunberg at Marlow, and that certainly leads color to the supposition that he's actually the colonel, since Anita's business was not of the nature to be discussed with a subordinate. No, the only thing that militates against that theory is the attempt to put you out of the way on the night of your arrival here. You saw Paget left behind at Cape Town. By no possible means could he have arrived here before the following Wednesday. He's unlikely to have any emissaries in this part of the world, and all his plans were laid to deal with you in Cape Town. He might, of course, have cabled instructions to some lieutenant of his in Johannesburg, who could have joined the Rhodesian train at Mafeking, but his instructions would have had to be particularly definite to allow of that note being written." We sat silent for a moment. Then Harry went on slowly. "You say that Mrs. Blair was asleep when you left the hotel, and that you heard Sir Eustace dictating to Miss Pettigrew. Where was Colonel Race?" "I couldn't find him anywhere." "Had he any reason to believe that you and I might be friendly with each other?" "He might have had," I answered thoughtfully, remembering our conversation on the way back from Matopos. "He's a very powerful personality," I continued, "but not at all my idea of the colonel. And anyway, such an idea would be absurd. He's in the Secret Service." "How do we know that he is? It's the easiest thing in the world to throw out a hint of that kind. No one contradicts it, and the rumor spreads until everyone believes it's gospel truth. It provides an excuse of all sorts of doubtful doings. Anne, do you like Race?"
"I do."
"And I don't. He repels me and at the same time fascinates me. But I know one thing. I'm always a little afraid of him." "He was in South Africa, you know, at the time of the Kimberley robbery," said Harry slowly. "But it was he who told Suzanne all about the colonel, and how he'd been in Paris trying to get on his track. Camouflage, of a particularly clever kind. But where does Paget come in? Is he in Race's pay?"
"Perhaps," said Harry slowly, "he doesn't come in at all."
"What? Think back, Anne. Did you ever hear Paget's own account of that night on the Kilmorden?"
"Yes, through Sir Eustace."
I repeated it. Harry listened closely. "He saw a man coming from the direction of Sir Eustace's cabin and followed him up on deck. Is that what he says? Now, who had the cabin opposite to Sir Eustace?
Colonel Race.
Supposing Colonel Race crept up on deck and, foiled in his attack on you, fled round the deck and met Paget just coming through the saloon door. He knocks him down and springs inside, closing the door. We dash round and find Paget lying there. How's that? You forget that he declares positively it was you who knocked him down. Well, suppose that just as he regains consciousness, he sees me disappearing in the distance. Wouldn't he take it for granted that I was his assailant? Especially as he thought all along it was I he was following.
It's possible, yes, I said slowly, but it alters all our ideas. And there are other things.
Most of them are open to explanation. The man who followed you in Cape Town spoke to Paget, and Paget looked at his watch. The man might have merely asked him the time.
It was just a coincidence, you mean?
Not exactly. There's a method in all this, connecting Paget with the affair.
Why was the mill house chosen for the murder? Was it because Paget had been in Kimberley when the diamonds were stolen? Would he have been made the scapegoat if I had not appeared so providentially upon the scene? Then you think he may be entirely innocent? It looks like it. But if so, we've got to find out what he was doing in Marlow. If he's got a reasonable explanation of that, we're on the right tack. He got up. It's just past midnight. Turn in, Anne, and get some sleep. Just before dawn, I'll take you over in the boat. You must catch the train at Livingston. I've got a friend there who'll keep you hidden away until the train starts. You go to Bulawayo and catch the Beira train there. I can find out from my friend in Livingston what's going on at the hotel and where your friends are now. Beira, I said meditatively. Yes, Anne, it's Beira for you. This is man's work. Leave it to me. We had had a momentary respite from emotion while we talked the situation out, but it was on us again now. We did not even look at each other. Very well, I said, and passed into the hut. I lay down on the skin-covered couch, but I didn't sleep. Outside, I could hear Harry Raeburn pacing up and down through the long dark hours. At last, he called me. Come, Anne, it's time to go. I got up and came out obediently. It was still quite dark, but I knew that dawn was not far off. We'll take the canoe, not the motorboat, Harry began, when suddenly he stopped dead and held up his hand. Hush! What's that? I listened, but could hear nothing. His ears were sharper than mine, however, the ears of a man who has lived long in the wilderness. Presently, I heard it too. The faint splash of paddles in the water, coming from the direction of the right bank of the river and rapidly approaching our little landing stage. We strained our eyes in the darkness and could make out a dark blur on the surface of the water. It was a boat. Then there was a momentary spurt of flame. Someone had struck a match. By its light, I recognized one figure, the red-bearded Dutchman of the villa at Meutzenberg. The others were natives. Quick, back to the hut! Harry swept me back with him. He took down a couple of rifles and a revolver from the wall. Can you load a rifle? I never have. Show me how. I grasped his instructions well enough. We closed the door and Harry stood by the window, which overlooked the landing stage. The boat was just about to run alongside it. Who's that? Called out Harry in a ringing voice. Any doubt we might have had as to our visitor's intentions was swiftly resolved. A hail of bullets splattered around us. Fortunately, neither of us was hit. Harry raised the rifle. It spat murderously, and again. I heard two groans and a splash. That's given him something to think about, he muttered grimly, as he reached for the second rifle. Stand well back, Anne, for God's sake, and load quickly. More bullets. One just grazed Harry's cheek. His answering fire was more deadly than theirs. I had the rifle reloaded when he turned for it. He caught me close with his left arm and kissed me once savagely before he turned to the window again. Suddenly, he uttered a shout. They're going! Had enough of it! They're a good mark out there on the water. They can't see how many of us there are. They're routed for the moment. But they'll come back. We'll have to get ready for them. He flung down the rifle and turned to me. Anne! You beauty! You wonder! You little queen! As brave as a lion! Black-haired witch! He caught me in his arms. He kissed my hair, my eyes, my mouth. And now to business, he said, suddenly releasing me. Get out those tins of paraffin. I did as I was told. He was busy inside the hut. Presently, I saw him on the roof of the hut, crawling along with something in his arms. He rejoined me in a minute or two. Go down to the boat. We'll have to carry it across the island to the other side. He picked up the paraffin as I disappeared. "They're coming back," I called softly. I had seen the blur moving out from the opposite shore. He ran down to me. "Just in time." "Why, where the hell's the boat?" Both had been cut adrift. Harry whistled softly. "We're in a tight place, honey. Mind?" "Not with you." "Ah, but dying together's not much fun. We'll do better than that. See, they've got two boatloads this time, going to land at two different points. Now for my little scenic effect." Almost as he spoke, a long flame shot up from the hut. Its light illuminated two crouching figures huddled together on the roof. "My old clothes, stuffed with rags, but they won't tumble to it for some time. Come, Anne, we've got to try desperate means." Hand in hand, we raced across the island. Only a narrow channel of water divided it from the shore on that side. "We've got to swim for it." "Can you swim at all, Anne?" "Not that it matters. I can get you across. It's the wrong side for a boat. Too many rocks. But the right side for swimming. And the right side for Livingston." "I can swim a little. Farther than that." "What's the danger, Harry?" For I'd seen the grim look on his face. "Sharks?" "No, you little goose. Sharks live in the sea. But you're sharp, Anne." "Crocs. That's the trouble."
"Crocodiles?"
"Yes. Don't think of them. Or say your prayers, whichever you feel inclined." We plunged in. My prayers must have been efficacious, for we reached the shore without adventure and drew ourselves up wet and dripping on the bank. "Now for Livingston. It's rough going, I'm afraid, and wet clothes won't make it any better, but it's got to be done." That walk was a nightmare. My wet skirts flapped round my legs, and my stockings were soon torn off by the thorns. Finally, I stopped, utterly exhausted. Harry came back to me. "Hold up, honey. I'll carry you for a bit." That was the way I came into Livingston, slung across his shoulder like a sack of coals. How he did it for all that way, I don't know. The first faint light of dawn was just breaking. Harry's friend was a young man of 20-odd who kept a store of native curios. His name was Ned. Perhaps he had another, but I never heard it. He didn't seem in the least surprised to see Harry walk in, dripping wet, holding an equally dripping female by the hand. Men are very wonderful. He gave us food to eat and hot coffee, and got our clothes dried for us while we rolled ourselves in Manchester blankets of gaudy hue. In the tiny back room of the hut, we were safe from observation while he departed to make judicious inquiries as to what had become of Sir Eustace's party, and whether any of them were still at the hotel. It was then that I informed Harry that nothing would induce me to go to Berra. I never meant to anyway, but now all reason for such proceedings had vanished. The point of the plan had been that my enemies believed me dead. Now that they knew I wasn't dead, my going to Berra would do no good whatever. They could easily follow me there and murder me quietly. I should have no one to protect me. It was finally arranged that I should join Suzanne, wherever she was, and devote all my energies to taking care of myself. On no account was I to seek adventures or endeavor to checkmate the colonel. I was to remain quietly with her and await instructions from Harry. The diamonds were to be deposited in the bank at Kimberley under the name of Parker. "There's one thing," I said thoughtfully. "We ought to have a code of some kind. We don't want to be hoodwinked again by messages purporting to come from one to the other." "That's easy enough. Any message that comes genuinely from me will have the word "and" crossed out in it." "Without trademark, none genuine," I murmured. "What about wires?" "Any wires from me will be signed Andy." "Train will be in before long, Harry," said Ned, putting his head in and withdrawing it immediately. I stood up. "And shall I marry a nice steady man if I find one?" I asked demurely. Harry came close to me. "My God, Anne, if you ever marry anyone else but me, I'll wring his neck. And as for you..." "Yes?" I said, pleasurably excited. I shall carry you away and beat you black and blue. What a delightful husband I've chosen, I said satirically. And doesn't he change his mind overnight?